Peace, everyone. This is Shalise, and welcome to another episode of YBE Radio. We're having a little technical difficulties, so we're going to play the intro music for a couple seconds, and then I'll be right back on the line with you. We are back. Thank you guys so much for bearing with me. I'm having a really long day. Someone just hit my car when I was getting ready to come in and prepare for the show. So please excuse me if I'm a little frazzled. Tonight is just going to be Sam and myself hosting the show. JB is feeling a little under the weather, so we're sending love and blessings out to her as well. Okay, so tonight our topic is going to be white privilege, fact or fiction. And we're going to be talking about White Privilege, White Tears, All Lives Matter. You know, some people don't believe that these concepts exist. They don't believe in white privilege. They don't believe in systematic racism. So I'm going to be bringing on the air someone very special, someone very intelligent, who I remember from my Hampton days as being no-nonsense with an infinite amount of knowledge. We're going to have Mr. Sharif Dejanay on the line in a couple minutes. He has 17 years in the education system, both public schools and private and higher education teaching. He taught a history class, which I had the pleasure of taking at Hampton. He's going to be on the air. I'm just going over the historical context of what white privilege is. A lot of the things that we're seeing out here nowadays, this is not the first time that we've seen them. We're basically going through, as Lovey put it, Groundhog Day. We're seeing the same incidents happening over and over again throughout history. So it's time to get educated so we can finally break this cycle and move forward with the betterment of our people. Before I bring Sharif on the line, I really do want to have a moment of silence for Laquan McDonald. If, you know, you haven't been on planet Earth in the last 24 hours, then you probably didn't know that a young man named Laquan McDonald was killed last year. And they recently just released the video of his murder by the police. He was shot 16 times in the back by an officer who was allowed to walk free for a year before he was actually charged with his murder. So we just want to send peace and blessings out to that young man's family. People have said that they haven't seen the video, and I hope that it stays that way because it was a very tragic and brutal killing, and I do hope that they find justice for him. So let's just take a moment. Okay, so now I'm going to be bringing Sam on the line with me. Sam, are you there?
No.
Sam.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now.
Great. No, I'm not feeling too well, so bear with me, but I'm here.
It's okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So give me one moment. I'm about to bring Sharif on the line.
Okay.
Greetings, King. How are you?
Good afternoon to everyone today. How are you doing today, Ms. Green?
I'm blessed. As I said, I'm a little frazzled, but bear with me. Hang in there with me, okay?
I definitely understand.
Okay, so before we get it started, what I want to do is I want you to explain a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so we stopped, so
we're going to get him back. Give us 1 second. Let's see if I can get Sharif. If you can hear me, please call back in. It looks like his call dropped. Okay, and we have him back.
I'm back.
And he's back. Okay. So we're just going to pick right back up. Tell the people a little bit about yourself, about your career in higher education, and what you're actually doing with yourself nowadays.
Okay. Once again, my name is Sharif Dejanet. I began my teaching career around 1998, which I was teaching in the public schools here in the state of Virginia. And then around 2003, I transitioned into higher education. And from 2003 to 2014, I taught in higher education, where I taught mostly history course here in the state of Virginia. Currently, I'm a full-time student working on my doctorate in education with a specialization in e-learning. And I also am working to build up my own private business, focusing mostly on educational services here in Williamsburg, Virginia. And so that's pretty much what I am focusing on these days.
Okay. Peace to that. So we're going to jump right into it.
Okay.
Now, Sharif, give me a definition. What is white privilege?
I would venture to say that white privilege is to be understood as benefits that are afforded to white persons and to gradations of whiteness that are not afforded to those persons who are black. And it's something that is largely germane to the Western Hemisphere, or all those nations that make up the first world for the most part. And so what I tried to do in that moment was to not only capture individuals that call themselves white, or what we understand as a social construct of white, but to also include those persons who are black but are lighter in shade, because they also sometimes get lumped into a type of privilege as well. So that's how I would shape it. So it's a privilege that is found in the political, social, and economic domains, but it's invisible. So it's something that you really can't see with your eyes, but it's something that you experience on a personal interaction on a daily basis.
Exactly, and it's funny that you say the word invisible, because I think that's one of the main reasons why people have a hard time of grasping the concept of what white privilege or systematic racism actually is, because these are things that you can't see. It's not just someone who doesn't like black people or someone who, you know, says rude things to black people. White privilege is something that even our allies, our white allies, are privy to, because even though they support us, they still benefit from the fact that they are indeed white.
Mm-hmm.
They still reap those benefits. In my research, I've discovered that, you know, the whole concept of color was invented. That's something mm-hmm. that was invented to separate us, to make even the poorest of the poor of white people feel like they are elevated above blacks, because above all people of color, because they are simply white. Their whiteness mm-hmm. elevates them.
Mm-hmm. And just to kind of provide a historical antidote to the conversation, we are in 1570, Jamestown, Virginia. And a man by the name of Nathaniel Bacon, who hails from England, has moved into the area, if you will, and he wishes to expand his industry beyond the Appalachian Mountains. Well, because he was blocked by the government in Jamestown here in Virginia, he was enraged by this because he felt that he should be able to do this. However, not understanding the issue with Native Americans beyond the Appalachian and also living in and around Jamestown at the time, they didn't want to bring further unrest to that topic. Well, anyway, Nathaniel Bacon went on to try to gather both indentured whites and blacks and enslaved blacks to lead a rebellion against the government of Jamestown. But for the fact that he fell ill in that moment, the revolution could have occurred and would have toppled the government in Jamestown. Well, what Jamestown decided to do was, in that moment, is when we see, among some other things, the consolidation of white nationalists, in that what was a divisor between poor whites
Hello? Sharif, are you still there?
We just lost him again.
And his call dropped again. It's okay, it's okay. Of course, if you're on the phone lines or if you're listening and you have something that you want to comment, make sure that you press 1 so we can see your number and we can bring you on the line. Name same. And we have Sharif back. But before I bring Sharif back on the line, I'm going to ask you, sis. What do you feel about the concept of white privilege? Because you actually have a lot of, you know, white friends. Like, we both do. We both have white friends. You've actually dated white women. So how has that affected you, you know, the whole concept of white privilege and bringing that up and systematic racism? How does that affect you when you're in a relationship or when you're interacting with people who happen to be white?
As terrible as this might sound, I kind of used it to my advantage. I realized it early on. I've had some experiences that most other people wouldn't have had they not been around and exposed to white privilege. So I can say for, you know, to a certain extent, I've seen kind of what some of the other side is like. So that's why when people, you know, talk about racism and, you know, then there's some people who say, well, it's classism and not just racism. I can sympathize with that, while at the same time kind of understanding that I can see the other side where people are like, no, it's racism. So it's definitely interesting. It's alive and well to this day. You can go out to eat and see that clear as day in a restaurant. It's not something that's hidden. It's not something that is now I would say actually maybe it is starting to become frowned upon, you know. But other than that, we all know it exists. I don't even think it's that. I think it's more so a conversation of how we should be combating it.
I think that, but to even say that we all know that it does exist, we all don't know that, because there are black people who don't believe that systematic racism exists, who don't believe that white privilege exists. You know, those are the people who you see with the All Lives Matter, you know, who are really, really into the white hugs and really, you know, who feel like they don't connect with the black community in some way. So they are very sympathetic to the fact of, oh, you know, white people, they're not racist. It's not about color. Why are you making everything about color? Why are you playing the race card? I get that a lot. Why are you playing the race card? When you simply point out the fact that we could both be dirt poor and homeless on the street, and someone will stop for, especially if it was me and a white woman, someone would stop for that white woman and help her simply
Absolutely.
Because of the fact that she is white. That's what separates us. It's the fact that because you are white, you already get the benefit of the doubt. You already
Which
get that.
True.
You get that right off the bat. You see,
no,
and even with the case of... Oh, okay. Come on with it.
I'm going to play devil's advocate on that one right there, and I don't mean to cut you off, but there are some people who will only, for example, there are some black people who will only stop for other black people. It, you know, they don't want to stop and help homeless white people because they feel, you know, we've all seen the well, not all of us because some people are a little young, but where they reveal, you know, the homeless people who got bins and they driving away from where they panhandled all day. You know, we've seen that. So there are some people who show bias on the other side as well.
I would stop helping the black person
you.
Simply because I know that it's going to be about who are going to stop to help that other person,
that
and it's going to be
Absolutely.
No one who stops for that black person.
But I'm not talking about you then. You're not that person that I'm talking about. But there are some people who, you know, they look and they're like, well, I'm not giving anything to a white person. You know what I mean? You have that mentality as well. So, I mean, you can't ignore that it exists. That's all I'm saying, is that we have to, you know, admit that it is there. That's all.
An example that I was going to use is where you can see, like, a clear bias, a clear separation when... That, I think he was 6 or 7 years old. There was a white child who, unfortunately, he was killed by the police. He was in the car with his father. I think the police officers who actually shot up the car, they actually had some kind of personal vendetta against the father. So they shot at this car with this child, this autistic nonverbal child, and his father, and the little boy was killed. There were two black officers. They were charged the next day. I mean, maybe not even the next day, maybe 2 days later. They were charged. There was no, we need to wait for more evidence. There was no, let the facts play out. There was nothing like that, nothing at all. And they have video of that circumstance, too. So now when you contrast that with the Laquan McDonald case, and you see that for a year this police officer was walking free while they, you know, did an investigation, but they knew how bad it was. They knew that. That's why they paid the family a settlement in April. Before the family even had a chance to sue, they already slipped them $5 million because they knew that the officer was wrong. So why is it that you charge those two officers who unfortunately shot that child? You charge them 2 days later, but it took you a year to shoot this officer that shot a 17-year-old 16 times in the back, and you have video?
Now, let me interject here. This is Chicago, right?
Yes, this happened in Chicago.
That's all. Nothing. It's Chicago. Okay. Nothing.
But on that
happened.
Note, I'm going to bring. On that note, what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring Sharif back on the line, and we're going to switch gears a little bit, and we're going to talk about these videos on social media, these videos of what we know to be public lynchings, and there's a reason why it is very triggering. But we can't continue to spread these videos because white supremacists, and I want to make it very clear, white people are not my enemy. I have many white friends. I have no issues with white individuals. My enemy is the system of white supremacy, a system that has oppressed and brutalized people of color globally throughout time. That's who my enemy is. So we cannot continue to spread these videos because all they show is they, you know, white supremacists, they get off on it. They like that shit. They enjoy it. It makes us seem weak because, yes, you can share those videos 100 million times, and you know what? That officer is still going to get fucking acquitted because it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. So give me one second. Sharif, you are back. I want you to speak on these videos. I saw you mention something about it today on Facebook, and you called it out for what it was, a public lynching.
Right. There's a couple of things that I heard your other guests speak to that I think oftentimes clouds the water, if you will, between racism, prejudice, and classism. And oftentimes those things are very much interconnected. But when you talk about, you know, present a theory, you have to be able to very much scope and specialize your words. Otherwise, it'll collapse if you have too much piled on top of it. So, for example, when he offered his conversation around what black people won't do for other black people, that has nothing to do with privilege at all. That has everything to do with self-hate issues within the community. Another issue that we have is really more about systems, okay, systems and institutions, right? Will Smith recently declared, if you will, through an interview that racism is no longer the issue, it's prejudice. What Will Smith fails to understand is that while no one in the 2015 is going to outwardly call you the N-word, which is what we all expect to hear, even still in this moment, the issue is that he forgets that he still sits in the room surrounded by perhaps four white males or maybe a white female, and he's the only African-American male in the room. It means that he has white men and perhaps maybe a white female or woman making decisions about how his labor or how his image needs to come across. And that is to the detriment of Will Smith because he doesn't have the collective energy of other African-Americans to play off of, to interact with. That is systematic. And in this case, it's systematic as it relates to how Hollywood is operating when it puts out its movies. Now, in relationship to the post that you referred to on my Facebook page today, what I want your listeners to understand is that shortly after emancipation, or before emancipation, let's start there, black people were easily worth $1,500 as a field hand prior to the abolition of slavery. If you would have added all of the enslaved persons, which was about 3.5 in number, we were worth more than every bank, railroad, and steamboat company in the United States at the time. And so once we became free, those 1% of white persons who owned black people lost value. So then whites had to come up with a way of trying to figure out how were they going to devalue the black body. This is when you see the rise of lynching. Okay. Now, it is not to say that whites were not disrespecting the black body prior to. However, we saw it on a much broader scale throughout the North, South, and the West during the era of emancipation through post-Reconstruction. And so what whites typically did was they lynched the black body, they took a picture of it, and they turned it into a postcard. They placed this postcard in the mailbox of all of the white residents in the area. Sometimes, not all the time. And what I was trying to argue was to simply say that this action of the early 20th century has morphed into our 21st century reality by way of using social media and all of its platforms. Make no mistake about it. We must ask the question, why is it, for example, when we saw the Paris attack, you saw no body of any of the victims? But if you look at the African situation with Nigeria, Mali, and elsewhere, or when you look at the situation related to Trayvon Martin and beyond, the looping of the death and the killing of the black bodies is continuous across all major networks. To me, I see this as an akin to what we saw from 1882 to 1936 with lynching of black people and postcards with the catching up of video technology. And so that's what I was presenting today on Facebook.
And I was in complete agreement with you, because when these videos are released, it starts a frenzy. You know, the media has to get you warmed up for it.
Mm-hmm.
It starts this huge frenzy, and people seem to feed all of that, feed off of it. It's so many. I mean, if you just go to Fox News and you look at the comments, I mean, the callousness of it's so blasé to them, because the same way that things are passed down from our ancestors to us, I truly believe that it works both ways. That callousness and that nonchalance towards violence, you know, that white individuals have about violence towards black individuals, they care nothing about it. They will rattle off those statistics and everything about, you know, the number of killings that are committed in black neighborhoods, like it's, I mean, with no feeling behind it. Because they're only just trying to prove a point to you. They don't really care about black-on-black violence. They don't really want you to care about black-on-black violence. They just want to say that, hey, you shouldn't give a fuck if I'm racist because y'all killing each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it is. So when we're sharing these videos, as you said, it's some kind of sick fascination that they have with wanting to see our bodies brutalized. They want to see us hurting. They enjoy that. And they enjoy justifying why we should be brutalized. And we've seen this throughout history. It's a continuum. It continues to happen because our people have not grasped, even our people have not grasped the concept of what racism really is and what white privilege is and what white supremacy is. I don't think that a lot of people have a clue what white supremacy really is and how it affects them on a daily basis.
Well, if
because
I might,
are invisible.
Well, if I might, Ms. Green, I have I tweeted in an attempt to attract attention around today's topic yesterday night around 7 o'clock, five of the biggest things that irritate me regarding white privilege. And I'll start from number five to number one that I think most of your listeners would appreciate. The first one, or number five, would be white people can act and wear what they like. So never does a white person have to think twice that somehow their outfit is going to be racy or perceived as making them anything else other than the superheroes that they may imagine themselves be, okay? So, for example, Miley Cyrus can wear something very buffoonish that a Nicki Minaj would get downgraded for.
Yeah,
no? Okay, I'm sorry. I couldn't hear. Okay, and then number four would be an act of white violence never condemns the group. As we already know, if a Muslim does something, the entire all Muslims are denigrated.
It's all Muslims. It's all Syrian refugees.
Right.
It's
so
all
both Sunni, both Sunni, Shiite, and all of the sub branches of Islam is condemned. Number three, white people can play any character in history in Hollywood and be viewed as believable. So this is another reason why black films get ghettoized, right? Because there's this belief that black films will never play well in any market, when the reality is there is a very strong appetite for black media across the globe, particularly in the third world and in the Asian world. But you wouldn't think so if you let Hollywood tell it. And beyond that, you know, white people can play any original black character and expect to have no repercussions. However, if a black person plays a historically white character, Santa Claus or Luke Skywalker in Star Trek, then there is a sudden, you know, upheaval within the white populace. Number two.
Well, you see that they just had before you go, but you see that they just had a white actor play Martin Luther King, and I think the director, who was black, he said, "Well, you know, we're just trying to challenge racial lines, and you know, white people have an affinity for Martin Luther King too." And to me, that was just so crazy, because you would never see, like you said, you would never see a black man playing JFK. You know, they're
right.
Not about to let that shit happen.
Right, right. And then number two, no one ever really questions the skills or education level of a white applicant. You know, for example, this would prove studies that we are seeing regarding the felon population, for example. A white felon is getting jobs faster than a black college graduate or a black high school graduate. All of these persons are ranked lower even in that demographic because of white privilege. And the last thing that we're, of course, talking about is white people never have to worry about protecting their children from systems and institutions. Why would they, when the systems and institutions are designed to protect them at the behest of profiting from black labor and black debt and grinding the black body at all costs? And we see this across the entire board. So white people grow up in their families never asking, do I have to or why not? It is automatically assumed that the world is yours. Whereas within the black community, we have to imagine if we rule the world, if I can borrow Nas's 1994 record with Lauryn Hill, for example. So this is what we are stuck with, or that we have to grapple with in the Tale of Two Cities, one white and one black, one with privilege, one without.
Exactly. And when you I really wanted to get someone on the line who doesn't believe in white supremacy and doesn't believe in white privilege, because there are black people out there. I actually just had, you know, like a very negative interaction with someone that I actually went to middle school with, who kind of rejected the notion of white privilege. You know, that same old white supremacy rhetoric regurgitated the "we're only holding each other back, there is no black community, you know, why should I boycott Black Friday? Why should I do that? Because it's only one day. It's not going to make a difference. You know, you're just hurting the economy." Come on now.
Right.
Come on. Right. And there are black people who will spit that white supremacist talk to you, and it just rolls off their tongue so easy. Because to them, what I like to tell myself is that I'm the exception. I'm not, I have to understand that I'm the exception, that I could be like any of these other people out here. You know, I could be like every other girl out here who may be lost in the world, but I just happen to have a strong support system around me. And I think that when people, when black people who feel like they are so elevated above their community that they don't connect with us in any way, you know, that's strange to me. That's kind of like, right. Whoa.
And I understand that perspective, but if I could insert something for just a moment, there's a term that I've been using, which is Negropean. And a Negropean, in essence, mm-hmm. is a black person that thinks white. However, the reason why this is the case is because this same black person suffers from the same thing that you and I suffer from, and that is the terrorism of white people. Rather, it occurred to us directly in our lifetime, or rather it was handed to us in a generational way that you had alluded to before. And one of the ways that white terrorism has been handed down to black people in a generational sort of way is, just look at the vocabulary that we use in the area of punishment of our kids. White people are more likely to say spank. We're more likely to say beat. But if you use that in mixed company, someone's going to think that you actually need to have the, you know, child protective services called on you. When, no, you're not necessarily beating your child to the point of they're going to be showing up to school at 8 o'clock in the morning with welts and carrying on in their body. It's just the terroristic language that's been handed down to us generation after generation after generation. I would also offer that the very same person who thinks that they're elevated above racism, they probably have a poor understanding about the Montgomery bus boycott movement and what that was really all about.
Yes, and I think that a lot of people don't, you know, we get this, I was thinking this morning about how a lot of people, they like to throw Dr. King in our faces when, you know, protests and riots started. Oh, well, you know, Dr. King, he believed in nonviolence and everything. If you watched Selma, then you could see that Martin Luther King was actually like a media genius in his time, because he knew how to play to the media. Television was new then. That was like a whole new thing for them. So when the cameras were rolling, he wanted people to see how brutal the police dealt with the protesters, even when they were being peaceful. He wanted people to see that splashed across newspapers and on television so that people could sympathize, because he needed more than just black people to be, you know, angry. He wanted them to be empowered to do something, and then he wanted the sympathy from whites in order to pressure the government. So I think personally that nonviolence was not just something that I think that was something that he used strategically.
A lot of people realize it. Absolutely. I mean, everything you said is actually spot on. And also in this moment that as we talk about racial schism, I don't want this or your listeners to think that this is we're advocating racism or that we are racist. That's not the case. So a quick historical plug is this. While the idea of abolition began with the very first slave individual who attempted to break free from his bondage and ran away, it began with black people. But sometime around 1830, whites began to pick up the mantle of abolition. And so my point is, both white and black played a role in freeing black people, just as the same whites of abolition became the abolitionists of the civil rights movement and joined with black people, not only in the civil rights movement, but also during the era of black power, which was from 1967 to about 1980. So we don't want to ostracize or suggest to your listeners that all white people are this way. However, I don't think your listeners understand historically that there's always been a break between progressive whites, both in the Women's March Women's Rights March and with respect to Black civil rights in this country. And that greatest survival has always been around race. And as soon as race is brought into the equation, unfortunately, our progressive and liberal allies who are white buckle to this issue, okay? And I'll give you a quick example of this. Hillary Clinton just provided a tweet regarding the McDonald's incident, okay, whereby she pretty much suggested that, you know, Black Lives Matter, even though she didn't directly say it like this, and that McDonald's life mattered and that justice is needed. However, she felt the need to add a byline in her conversation by saying, we must recognize, if you will, what good cops are doing, and we must learn from these good cops. That's part of the problem. When you discuss a problem, you don't have to keep deflecting to what is already understood. We know that there are good cops. Or apologizing or what have you. Let's stick to the topic, which is right now at this moment, the house that is on fire is the Black House. The White House is not on fire, which would include, you know, white persons, good cops, good teachers, that whole conversation. Right now, the people who need water on them and to cool this fire until the next fire, if I could borrow James Baldwin for a moment, are Black. And so I think that that's kind of the conversation that needs to be understood. The house that's on fire right now are Black people, and Black people don't need to be disrespected by asking, well, what about Black-on-Black crime, or what about gang violence, or what about, we know all of these things because there have been movements across every four Black and brown community dealing with that issue. We are talking about an issue where you have the state under the police banner versus the American citizen, and that is what needs to be understood, and that is the severe problem at this time.
Okay. So what I'm going to do right now is I see that we do have a caller, and I'm going to bring them on the line. 917-861, are you there? 917-861. Okay. Let's try this one.
Hello?
917-861.
Hello, yes. Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, hello? Peace. What's going on? Hello?
Yes, how are you? How are you? How's it going?
I'm fine. Carla, what's your name?
My name is Rodney Green, and I'm I actually have a relation to the, you know, eloquent brother that you have speaking right now on your show. I was one of his students at Hampton University, coming from Queens, New York. Hope everybody out there is having a good night. Yes, sir. Yes, indeed. And I enjoy so much of this conversation because it's a lot that needs to be said and just understood. And I appreciate the education that you're allowing to be, you know, brought out to everybody who's listening. And I just think it's a great thing. And, yeah. Hello?
Yeah, we're still right here with you.
Oh, yeah. Also, I kind of wanted to speak to what Sharif had mentioned and how people try to use this excuse use the black-on-black crime and, you know, the problems that we have within our own communities to kind of take away from the, you know, actions that are brought upon us. And even so, in some of my conversations, I think people don't lack so much understanding. And for one, racism is probably the most ignorant form of anything I've seen, and it's just out of a lack of understanding. But also, in that, people don't understand how those communities came to be in the situation that they're in, and how those crimes, how people resort to those crimes are committed. And it comes from, I think, me personally, coming from a neighborhood that was once like that, in which a lot of crime, I guess you could say, black on black occurred. It really comes from a lack of resources. A lot of kids who grew up in those same communities, I have friends who I grew up with in the classroom, and they, for whatever reason, because they didn't have the guidance that I had or was fortunate to have at home, they just, you know, they didn't have somebody to be there for them to tell them that, you know, stay the course. Now, in certain communities like these, you have some kids don't see no other way as to get into a better situation than resort to crime. And, you know, even if you want to reference, you know, even the music that we listen to, Jay-Z, you know, that's sometimes that's all some kids have to resort to is the crime and that violent nature. And it's not their fault. It's just that we don't sometimes we don't have those resources or those mentors or those people who care. And even if we do, they can only do but so much. So I really think it stems from a lack of resources. And I think that people shouldn't jump on that whole, you know, you have that it's black on black crime and whatnot, because it's really results from some help that we should be getting, but that we're really not. I mean, we as in those black communities, because it's only but so much we can do without those resources. Similar to what we see with HBCUs. And I have friends who, I'm sorry if I'm jumping from place to place, but I have friends who went to PWI.
Oh, can
and they
you
talk about, they talk about how, you know, they talk about how they, you know, they just don't think of much of a HBCU as they do their school. However, we see in places like, you know, at University of Missouri, you can see that now it's public, I guess now it's public knowledge, but there's been other places where there's no love there. Yeah, you go to school there and you spend your money there, but are they really embracing you, or are they just taking your money because that's all they need from you? As to where I went to HBCU, and I can say, just like the reason why I'm on this show now is because I came across a professor who didn't even teach me, who took a specific interest in me to help me develop into the man I am now. So not saying that you won't see that at another school, but there's a lot more of that I can say based on my relationships that I've had with friends who went to other schools. They can't say the same. And they and some have even endured some of those what we hear about and that's being spoken on at University of Missouri or other schools across the nation, that happened. But the whole point I think where people miss about HBCUs, that was something that I think was established where, hey, I think it's the same as black ownership. Let's start our own schools, let's educate ourselves and let's make something of ourselves to help the next person coming up. So I just think, you know, it's a lack of understanding that, and, you know, it just has to be at some point where we all have to come together and just help improve each other and then help the next young man or young woman that's up next and help them to just, you know, educate themselves and to be able to help ourselves, because that's the only way certain things are going to change. It's only but so much we can say to the next white person who might not understand, because at the end of the day, some people are stuck in their ways, but that's anybody. So it's only but so much we can do, but every little bit helps.
True, true. Well, I thank you for calling in and, of course, showing that HU love.
Sharif, of course. Sharif?
Let me make sure I do. Yes. Sharif.
Hello.
Okay, guys.
Thank you so much for having me. Appreciate it.
No problem. You have a great night. Peace, King.
Now,
I want you to touch on something for me, Sharif. Now, he mentioned something very important. He mentioned the incident that happened, well, the protests in Missouri that have caused this ripple effect throughout predominantly white institutions with a lot of protesting, and the schools are, for the most part, giving in to the protesters. They are agreeing, hey, you know what, this just may not be a welcoming, warm space for a person of color. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen in response to that is all of these new Facebook pages for white student unions.
Mm-hmm.
And it so reminded me of the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. That's mm-hmm. how the Klan started, in response to the economic progress and the educational progress of African Americans during Reconstruction. They couldn't fucking take it. They couldn't
mm-hmm.
take it.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't take that. They can't take the fact that those students are actually standing up for themselves and are actually saying, no, you need to make this place safe for me to be a black person because I'm paying you to be here.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to make the changes. I don't need to change my attitude. You need to change this institution. And then you see all these media pundits saying, well, they're destroying free speech. See, this is how the conversation has evolved. It's no longer racism. It's free speech. Why are you punishing me? Because we live in the United States and it's free speech. If I call you a nigger, well, I'm just playing around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just joking. I said that in the privacy of my own home. As if that makes it any less racist. Because they didn't say it to a black person. They were just saying it in an email or they were just saying it in a text or something. Therefore, they're not racist because they didn't shout it in your face. Again, unsure about what racism really is. These students creating those white student unions, to me, that just reeks of white supremacy and white privilege. Because what the hell do you need a white student union at a damn near all-white school? What do you need that for?
That's
just to say that, you know what, we're going to let you know who's running this shit around here. We're going to band together, too.
Well, there's a long history that you just now spoke to when you introduced the Klan of what is understood as white nationalism. So that's one. It's so much that can be said. For example, one of the things that is valuable at Tampa University is that sometime around 1996, they made it a requirement that all enrolling students had to take either a Black History course or a World Civilization course, with most students electing to take a Black History course, which is where I met scores of students during my years at the university. Having said that, my point of referencing that is that that is something that needs to be replicated at the PWI. PWIs are to embrace all of its enrolling students to take some type of diversity course that all of its matriculating students pass through so they can have an understanding about the history. Now, while I don't have time to get into the whole safe space argument and debate, because that's something that I don't really get, because that's not really reasonable in my opinion. We live in a world that's angry. We live in a world that's loving. We live in a world that's a whole bunch of things, and to try to create these uniform spaces in whether it's private or public, it's not something I care to even discuss because it makes zero sense to me. I think the way that you crush that sort of ignorance would be to simply have a course that all students pass through whereby they learn about each other, and this would cut down on perhaps what we're seeing. In addition to the PWI needs to hire at least 15% in terms of the African-American representation, that's our general population number within its university population. That means that they need to make sure that within this department they have at least two Black professors department, and they want to make sure that these professors are also tenured or on the tenure track and that they're ensuring that they're keeping these persons at the PWI, because the role of the Black professor or any minority professor at a PWI is so very important in the 2015. And so that's what I would say. The Missouri incident, the Yale, which was known as the Marshall Resilience incident, or the Ithaca incident. Since that, you've seen all universities buckle quickly, from VCU here in Richmond, Virginia. Recently, the Townsend University president, which is a school in Maryland, quickly buckled in 8 hours. The Black students took over the administration building, and the president signed a demand in 8 hours. But let's be very clear as to why that happened. That happened largely because of what the University of Missouri football team did, complete with 30 Black football players and their white allies, along with the coaching, which would have tripled the university at $1 million. And so the university understands this. I don't care what university it is, understands this. You triple their economics. And this is something that we learned from the Montgomery bus boycott. The reason why the Montgomery bus transportation system buckled within 365 days, albeit 365 days it took them, was because they can't hope to make money if they have no riders. So the only way that I think that the millennial student or the millennial generation is going to be successful is they're going to have to study what Montgomery bus boycott people did, what Rosa Parks did, and they're going to have to look at what Martin Luther King was trying to effectuate in 1968, a couple of months before his assassination, when he was trying to organize the Poor People's Campaign. These two events coalesced in the mind of the millennial using smartphone, using YouTube, using retweet, using repost, using picture, can be the change that Barack Obama was decrying back in 2008. And that's how I see it, although I'm not a millennial myself. You know, I'm of the Generation X, you know, the generation that everybody thought was also lost. But I think that what I can bequeath to the millennial generation is a reminder about Montgomery bus boycott did to cripple the economics, what the Selma March did in terms of imagery, what you mentioned earlier about what MLK did by unleashing the students in Birmingham and allowing those water hoses to be sprayed upon those black bodies, tumbling them all across the streets of Birmingham. And then lastly, what all of America feared was the Martin Luther King March of the Poor People's Rebellion, which at that moment in 68, King was at his lowest rate by way of public perception. When King died, he was not highly revered, both by whites or by a large swath of black people. And that is something that we quickly forget because we want to keep him in 1963 land when he gave us that I Have a Dream speech. But by 1968, he was sounded more like Malcolm X than he was in the case from 1955 to 1963. So there's so much archive that we need to understand that we
lose. Yeah, they broke that.
Yeah.
Oh, no, you see how they broke? Because during the ends of their lives, Martin and Malcolm realized that they had more in common than they had ever realized, that their thoughts started to align. They both had made significant changes in their ideologies. And imagine if those two men had joined their movements. Imagine if they had joined. Imagine if even, you know, Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, imagine if they had, you know, decided to stop being polar opposites and actually combine those two movements. See, that is why there will always be some type of confusion and division within our movements because it is created. It's designed so that this group is saying, oh, no, you know, we don't bang with that group over there because they don't say, we don't represent the same things. And but why can't we work together on the ideals that we do stand tall together on? Why can't we find some common ground so that we can show solidarity? That's what it's all about. During the Montgomery bus campaign, there was not one, but you had to get with the movement. If you wasn't with the movement, we wasn't dealing with you. And our community needs to get like that again, where we are not tolerating people who are not about empowering and advancing our communities. We have to change the conversation. We have to change the environment.
I think the problem is, if I can borrow Barack Obama's concept of common ground, I think, well, the first thing is, you know, if you look in the archive, you will see that the black community has never been a monolithic in thought group, meaning that, for example, when we first had the concept of repatriation in Liberia, and that was the moment when the United States decided to purchase land in West Africa to send both historically free blacks and runaways to Liberia, and Southern government, along with the American Colonization Society, actually supported this endeavor and funded it and sent people back to Africa. People like Paul Cuffy, for example, who was a noted shipbuilder, he actually ended up dying here in the United States. But there was a division even within that populace. So you had about, between 1820 to about 1840, some 5,000 black people that exited the United States during that moment into Liberia. But you also had a large movement of black people who decried, I'm not West African, I know nothing about Africa. All I know is, say, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, New York, whatever state they have represented. So we've always had a schism. The other problem that we've had in the community is the failure to bring upon woman leadership very quickly. We all know that the black woman has always been the backbone and the spine of communication, of typing, of the marches on the front line. But for far too long, the voice of the black community has always been black men. So what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to point out all the schisms. Lastly, at this moment, although they've always been there, color is now demanding a voice which we're failing to bring aboard. And so until we learn how to find what the touch points are for every community that we can create one solid plan for, we're always going to suffer from the schism. Until every group is able to see itself in some type of unified plan, you're always going to be able to get picked off. And that is why the powers that be are able to pick off various individuals within the black community, pick them off, use wedge issues against them, such as religion, race, class, and sexual orientation, to pull large groups of black people that will ultimately collapse any of our movements. And that's just what it's been since the, you know, since about 1954 when the civil rights movement is said to have began for all of this. Up to the present.
So give me 1 second. I'm going to bring on another caller right
yes,
now.
Ma'am.
661-433. Are you there? Again, 661-433. Are you there? Okay. If you don't say something, I'm going to have to drop you, honey. Okay. So gone. Okay. So to my last point of the night, because we're probably going to wrap up a little early, because I have to make some gift baskets for, well, we're not making gift baskets. We're actually delivering bag lunches and also care packages to the homeless tomorrow. So my sisters, Michelle and Tierra, are actually downstairs. They are actually working hard while I'm up here on the show. But another thing that I wanted to touch on was the shooting of the 5 protesters in Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those white supremacists, they made videos, uploaded them to social media saying that they had guns and they were going to shoot a whole bunch of black people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if someone black had done that, they would have tracked our IP addresses, found our asses, and we would have been in jail that same day. You see how it goes down when people make threats on Twitter and Facebook. So now you have premises, and one was actually Latino. That's what they said, that one was actually Hispanic. So you have these two white supremacists who actually were basically given the leeway to open fire on these protesters, and then the police turn around and attack the protesters.
Mm-hmm.
And you see so many people who really do not understand, who really don't identify or empathize with these protesters, because they feel like, oh, I mean, yes, I understand that we're tired of marching, we're tired of protesting, but I want you to speak to what is the importance of the protesting and the marching in today's climate, saying that, you know, and I understand that we do have to back that up by withdrawing our economic support from these businesses, you know, following the lead of Martin Luther King, but they also protested. You know, they sat at lunch counters. They marched through streets. They held up traffic. They did all of that because they wanted to disrupt the system. But you see so many people now who are very, very against these who are very, very against these protesters, and some of them are even within the black community. And I also want you to comment on rioting as well.
No, none of the protests have erupted into riots, but sometimes people get protesting and rioting confused. They get it a little mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
So please break that down for us real quick.
Before I do, I didn't want to monopolize all the time. I can't remember your other guest's name. I don't know if you wanted to speak out or add something before I did. I don't know.
Sammy,
I think
he's watching.
What was that, me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah,
I wanted to hear you and then I could come behind
No,
you.
That's my sister. That's actually my sister, Samara, Sam.
No, actually, I'm looking forward to hearing your answer on that. I'll come behind you on that one.
Okay, I will start off. First, the history of protesting goes all the way back to the formation of these United States, right? I mean, all you got to do is remember probably your second grade lesson when you learned about the Boston Tea Party. That was a protest. Now, I'm not going to unpack the racial problems with that right now. I just want to stick to the conversation of what protesting is. So, in essence, protesting is as democratic as everybody thinking that somehow Greece gave us the idea of democracy, okay? So that goes to the common core of what we are as the United States of America. Next, with respect to the role of protesting, rebellion, and withdrawal of money, now let's be very clear about the divisor. Whenever whites riot, it is never in the name of justice. We just got to be factually honest about that archive. When whites riot, it is always about because they fear that somebody is trying to take something from them. And you can list any racial riot that you want to that is listed in your standard United States history book, whether it's Brownsville to Rosewood to Tulsa to everything in between. It is whites upset about the economy, thinking that blacks are above themselves, thinking that blacks are trying to take jobs from them. We see the same thing cycling, except it's this time it's whites and possibly some black allies thinking that the person coming from the Latin American world is trying to take something from them. Well, let's be very honest. The jobs that they are getting are jobs that nobody wants, or you need to blame the businessman for giving them these jobs because they're taking advantage of the immigrant. And it's not the immigrant taking advantage of the system the way the media wants everybody to think. So that is a political wedge issue that people use to turn people into what is known as political football. Next, why I myself do not advocate violence, so I wouldn't necessarily, you know, been on the front line of that kind of conversation. But let us be clear. For the most part, you cannot have a revolution without violence. I know of no moment in history where this has not been true. Even if you look at the Communist Manifesto written by Karl Marx, he speaks to the very same issue. And that document is over 150 some odd years old when he wrote this document. So what makes you think that somehow, because nonviolence emerged on the scene with people like Gandhi in India and then replicated it in MLK, that somehow it's going to disappear off the face of the earth. This is just simply not true. Every time a situation has occurred within the black community related to a revolt or inner-city violence, I can tell you that this touch point has always been around policing, poor education, and the fact that jobs left that city and ran to the suburbs, leaving the people trapped. And so all of this has caused for a deadly mix that we have seen in our nation since about 1965 to the present with respect to black rebellion in the United States. And I'm not including slave rebellion because that's separate and aside for our present conversation. So I hope your listeners understand the timeline and the archive that I tried to present in that moment.
Yeah, and to piggyback off of that, I definitely think that a nonviolent approach is At some point, there's going to be violence. It's only so far that you can go without it. The only issue that I see coming forth is that you have a lot of people who aren't going to be willing to defend themselves. They're going to... We have a lot of people who are ill-prepared. You know, I have family members who just for them to hear this conversation, they would probably just, you know, oh, whatever, you know, y'all just talking crazy. You know how people are. And that's going to be what largely determines the outcome of how this revolution or, you know, this movement, however you decide to term it, goes. It's really like a personal preference, I would say. I think and self-preservation is definitely a key factor to that. And you have some people, you know, you either have it or you don't. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as the protesting versus rioting, I think that rioting sends a message, but not necessarily the message that it was intended to be delivered.
Mm-hmm.
And it all depends on how the media spends it. Mm-hmm. And when you let it become a riot, you kind of lose your voice in it. It's no longer yours. You lose your power, you know.
Mm-hmm.
If you can control the media, what?
No, because I was going to say, when you talked about the media spend, that's true, because what's the difference between a bonfire, a large bonfire involving cars and violence after a football game, and a riot? Because they still property
the race of the people involved, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, and I know exactly what you mean. You know, at a good championship game, the first thing that, you know, a city will do is tear itself apart. And it's crazy because that's supposed to be a celebration. And it's like you're killing your own stuff, but it's a celebration. And, and people can't fathom the concept. And when people get upset, they will tear their own stuff up. And it's like, really, for me, and this is just my own personal opinion, I think that it's because so many people forget that at the end of the day, we're still human. And human is still mammal, and mammal is still animal. So when you remember where you come from, really, and it's not to say, because a lot of people get, I didn't come from a monkey. I'm not talking about evolution. I'm not talking about any of that stuff. It's just simply remember that it's two sides to every person. We have our good days. We have our bad days. There are people who have, you know, been blacked out and done things I'm quite sure they wish they never done. So it happens to the best of us, you know, and it's not to excuse, you know, any behaviors, but it definitely is one of those, like, beauty is in the eye of the beholder type situations. Because if you let them tell it after a baseball game, you know, it's just some young teenage punks who, you know, they just getting their frustrations out or whatever, and, you know, we thugs and killers and rapists and murderers. So, but that's just history playing itself out all over again. And I feel like, unfortunately, you have so many ill-informed children that it's just going to continue to be a cycle, because I really don't even know any people who could tell you who Karl Marx is. And that's pretty sad to say. History is most people's least favorite subject besides math. And it definitely shows in the way that the things are playing out in our society.
I don't know if I could say this. One of the things I believe, and I tend to think in a more, you know, optimistic point of view, and I always give people the benefit of the doubt, I really do think that people know more than what we give them credit for. Even though, you know, you might have a person that dropped out of school, they still retain or know enough information up to whatever point they dropped out, which, for the most part, in Black world, it tends to be sometime around 9th grade and 10th grade when they dropped out. So they've already received enough of the historical archive to make, you know, many types of interpretations and understanding, even if they can't remember all of the 13 colonies. And I don't think it's necessarily relevant if a person knows who Karl Marx is. I think that at the end of the day, most of us can point to all of white history and can point to the fact that at the end of the day, between 1775 and 1781, there was something in this 83, there was something in this country called the American Revolution, in which in that particular moment, it was Great Britain that brought all of their weaponry to us. We didn't go to London, but the bottom line is we did a number of things during what's known as the American Revolution in an attempt to get our independence. And that is the same sort of thing that's going on here in these United States with black people. It's not that we're trying to necessarily separate out and form a new country, although that was discussed during the era of Henry Garnett, who later became president of Wilberforce University in Ohio, who dared talk about black nationalism under a level that people did not or could not imagine within these United States. He actually wanted to have an all-black nation in Oklahoma when it was a territory. So we had that kind of conversation. But I think the larger point is that, as I think both of you have stated, but for the fact that it's race and it's black people doing it, it is white people saying the audacity, the nerve of these people demanding anything from us. We allocate to them what they are allowed from them, who we want to raise up. And that is part of what supremacy, privilege, and the structural inequality that we are witnessing has really always been all about. The wedge issues that messes this all up, even within the black community, as I stated before, are the following dynamics. When you talk about religion, you're going to get a schism in the black community. When you talk about gender, men versus women, you're going to get a schism in the black community. And once again, we see it in the white community, but I'm only focused on the black community for our conversation today. When you talk about economics, you understand that we have an economic issue in the black community that we don't like to talk about, and that is our poor brothers and sisters need a lot of help. And they're also not necessarily upholding their end of the bargain as well, but too many black and upper class black people want to run away from the hood and move into the suburbs or go off to PWI in an attempt to escape black realities, and I get it. And then the last thing that causes a schism in our community, as I mentioned before, and this is my latest issue that I've been pushing really hard besides the issue of poverty in the black community and also the issue of felon issues in the black community, but the LGBT community of color. These individuals are also at risk in our community that needs to be brought into the fold very quickly. We have no time to not acquiesce this group into our community, contrary to whatever the black church is saying and other conservative black people might be saying, broadly speaking.
Okay. Now, we're going to table that for another for our next show, because we are going to get into that in our next show about the black LGBT community. But I'm going to hit these callers off real quick because we have about 4 minutes left. 661-433. Call, are you there?
Hello?
661. Yeah.
Yes, this is Kiva Paris.
Hi, did you have a comment? You just want to shout out Sharif?
How are you doing? Yes, I would definitely like to give a shout out to my mentor, big brother. Definitely guided my steps and made me understand with purpose the way I need to go. I want to say I appreciate you for everything you've done, big bro, and I just want to say you shine.
Thank you. Yeah, you're still there. Sharif, did you want to say hi?
Thank you, Brother Paris. I definitely appreciate it. And at this moment, and I know that we're probably going to have wind downs, but I just want to thank the brothers of Cap Alpha Psi Fraternity Incorporated for listening in to this conversation, and also my brothers out there who hold the light very strong, which are all the Masons out there. And, of course, all of my friends and family from Virginia State University and Hampton University who are also listening, all my friends out there in the Hampton University land, I definitely do appreciate you listening today.
Okay. So we got two more callers to hit off in 3 minutes. 917-861, are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. I had dialed back, but I just want to say this was a great conversation. It was well needed. Big shout out to, you know, my brother and mentor, Sharif, on this educational experience. Also, thank you for hosting. You were lovely. Shout out to Hampton University. It's all love, and I just want you guys to have a good night.
Thank you.
Have a blessed night as well, brother. And our last caller for tonight, 313-622.
Hello.
Hello. How are you? Yeah, I can hear you.
I'm good. My name is DeAndre Bond. I was just calling my brother Sharif. We go way back. How you doing, brother Sharif?
I'm doing fine, brother Bond. How are you?
I'm good. I was just listening in to this wonderful conversation going on. I just wanted to just share some things. White privilege, you know, they describe it as a informal racism to the formal racism, you know, slavery followed by Jim Crow. At the end of the day, we as African Americans, black people, we don't have no leaders. So when it's time to stand on that front line, we got to stand there, because if we don't, if we run backwards, run side to side, we going to hurt each other. We got to stand on that front line. So when that right privilege kick in and they come and say, we taking everything over, we going to need somebody to stand there. So I definitely give it up to everybody on the line, all the callers that have called in tonight. Believe in what you say, you know, be there, be an African-American leader. I'm actually sitting at home listening. I'm a Hampton University grad as well, you know, that good HU. But Brother Sharif know my story, and I know he is. And just stay black, stay powerful, stay peaceful. I let y'all. Love you, brother.
I love you, too. Thank you so much, Brother Bond.
All day.
Okay, so thank you all for calling in tonight. Sharif, thank you so much for being with us. I truly appreciate you. Again, we will be back here in another 2 weeks to continue this conversation. Our next topic is going to be the Black LGBT community and ways that we can support the Black LGBT community. Also, before we end, I just want to start a tradition of us ending in prayer. If you're not religious, I understand, but I ask that the Creator covers you all with safety and blessings, and that wherever you go, you carry knowledge, love, and power. Ashe, good night, everyone. Be blessed, be safe, stay black.
Ms. Green.